Bhate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're continuing our reading of the 13th chapter of the 7th canto entitled Behavior of a Perfect Person. And text 43. Vikalpam juhuyak chittau mamanasyarta vibrame mano vaikarike hutva tanmayayam juhotyanu Vikalpam juhuyak chittau tang manasyarta vibrame mano vaikarike hutva tang mayayam juhotyanu Vikalpam juhuyak chittau Tamanasyarta vibrame manovaikarike hutva tangmayayam juhotyanu Ladies, please. Vikalpam, discrimination between good and bad, one person and another, one nation and another, and all similar discrimination. Juhuyat, one should offer as oblations. Chittau, in the fire of consciousness. Tam, that consciousness. Manasi, in the mind. Arta vibrame, the root of all acceptance and rejection. Manaha, that mind. Aikarike, in false ego. Identification of oneself with matter. Hutva, offering as oblations. Tam, this false ego. Mayayam, and the total material energy. Jahoti, offers as oblations. Anu, following this principle. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The mental concoction of discrimination between good and bad should be accepted as one unit and then invested in the mind, which should then be invested in the false ego. The false ego should be invested in the total material energy. This is the process of fighting false discrimination. Purport. This verse describes how a yogi can become free from material affection. Because of material attraction, a karmi cannot see himself. Jnanis can discriminate between matter and spirit, but the yogis, the best of whom are the bhakti yogis, want to return home, back to Godhead. The karmis are completely an illusion. The jnanis are neither an illusion nor impositive knowledge. But the yogis, especially the bhakti yogis, are completely on the spiritual platform, as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 14:26. Mangchyo vyabhicharena bhakti yogena sevate, sagunan samatityaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. One who engages in full devotional service, who does not fall down under any circumstances, at once transcends the mode's material nature, and thus comes to the level of Brahman. Thus a devotee's position is secure. A devotee is at once elevated to the spiritual platform. Others, such as jnanis and hatha yogis, can only gradually ascend to the spiritual platform by nullifying their material discrimination on the platform of psychology and nullifying their false ego, by which one thinks, I am this body, a product of matter. One must emerge from the false ego into the total material energy, and merge the total material energy into the supreme energetic. This is the process of becoming free from material attraction. Om Agyana Timurandasya Akinanjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmi Litang Yena Tasmai Shri Yudhavai Namaha Namaham Vishnu Bhattai Krishna Sabudali Shimate Paladananda Saitone Namaham Vishnu Bhattai Krishna Sabudali Shimate Bhaktivedanta Saitone Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Charne Nirvishesha Shuni Vati Pashyati Adesha Charne. So in this particular section of the Bhagavatam, we're getting some very nice instructions from this Paramahansa Avadhut in the jungle, who's adopted the austerities of a python. And because his level of realization is so advanced, it can be difficult to comprehend, especially for an average person in the world right now, to comprehend these different types of things that he's talking about. I mean, after all, how can you mentally assimilate these different things? He's describing things that are not tangible. They're intangibles. You can't see them. You can't touch them. You can't feel them. But he's describing them in terms as if you could. You know, how do you take your discrimination of good and evil? How do you manipulate that? How do you deal with that? You know, these are very esoteric concepts. For that matter, the majority of Krishna consciousness is dealing with things on this very subtle matter. It's dealing with things that are intangible, that you can't practically see and touch and feel and taste. Because the real transformation occurs within the heart. It's not something that can be seen by other people or seen visibly by you either. Rather, it's something that only you and Krishna and your guru know about. So, in the beginning, everyone is starting out on this level of, you know, being full of material desires. And this is what causes all these other things. You know, the false ego, this discrimination between good and bad. It's because I'm thinking that I have these different desires, and based upon these different desires, there's different competitors, different people competing to try to acquire the same things that I want to acquire. We're living in a world with limited resources. So if I let somebody else achieve what I'm trying to achieve, then I'll possibly miss out on my desired goal. So therefore, I need to eliminate my competitors. This is the root of where all different ideas of good and evil, friends and enemies, where it all comes from. That's why in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, text 70, Krishna says, Apuryamanam achala pratishtam samudram apat pravishanti yadvat tadvat kama yang pravishanti sarve sashantim apnoti nakama kami. A person who is not disturbed by the incessant flow of desires that enter like rivers into the ocean, which is ever being filled, but is always still, can alone achieve peace, and not the man who strives to satisfy such desires. So, the average person that's here in this material world falls in this category. They're here trying to satisfy all their different desires. And these desires are never ending. They're flowing like rivers into the ocean. And it's based upon this different flow of desires and our attachment to them. In fact, it's extremely bewildering. Because all our senses are placing so many different demands upon our consciousness. We see something nice with our eyes, naturally we want to look at it. We taste something nice with our tongue, we want to taste more of it. We hear something nice with our ears, we want to hear it more. We feel something nice with our fingers, we want to feel it more. And at every moment, we're constantly being bombarded. All our senses are being barraged with all this different sensory stimulus, input. And so we're constantly being pulled in so many different directions. And then our mind is contemplating all these different possibilities, all these different things that could be, these things that have been, and these things that we want more. And so in this way, we never achieve a peaceful state of existence. That's why it's so important that we take instruction from self-realized souls. Because this material existence is so bewildering that simply by existing, simply by being here just for a little bit of time, and automatically our intelligence becomes bewildered. Just like it describes earlier in the Bhagavatam, I believe it's third canto when it's talking about the process of spirit soul taking birth within this material world. When the spirit soul is still within the womb, it's thinking, oh my dear Lord, please don't let me forget. This is a terrible existence. I'm being, you know, bitten by worms, packed up in this womb, and it's so miserable. Please don't let me forget your devotional service. And then as soon as we're born, constant bombardment of the material energy. To where by the time that we can even become conscious of our memories, we don't even know anything about the Supreme Lord anymore. That's how fast it happens. But then there's cases like, for instance, Prahlad Maharaj, earlier in this canto. Prahlad Maharaj heard instructions from Narada Muni while he was within the womb. And he remembered those instructions. And so he began teaching his fellow classmates because he couldn't see the point in the instruction he was receiving from his teachers. Their names were Shunda and Amarka. And so he was teaching his classmates, and then his classmates started getting these different ideas. And then the parents of his classmates started complaining to the teachers, "What are you teaching our children at school? Why are you teaching them all these false teachings? That Vishnu is the supreme and that we need to worship and serve Vishnu. What is this nonsense? We sent our children to school so they could learn about how to dominate and control the entire world. So why is this happening?" And so Shunda and Amarika did some inquiry, and they found out that actually Pallad was the source of all this. And so they're asking Pallad, "Where did you get this false information from? From what enemy did you hear this?" So Prahlad's response, which is text 11 through 14 in the fifth chapter of this canto, Prahlad says, "Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose external energy has created the distinction of my friend and my enemy, by deluding the intelligence of men. Indeed, I am now actually experiencing this, although I have previously heard of it from authoritative sources. When the Supreme Personality of Godhead is pleased with the living entity because of his devotional service, one becomes a pundit and does not make distinctions between enemies, friends, and himself. Intelligently, he thinks, every one of us is an eternal servant of God, and therefore we are not different from one another. Persons who always think in terms of enemy and friend are unable to ascertain the supersoul within themselves. Not to speak of them, even such exalted persons as Lord Brahma, who are fully conversant with Vedic literature, are sometimes bewildered in following the principles of devotional service. The same personality of Godhead who has created this situation has certainly given me the intelligence to take the side of your so-called enemy. O Brahmins, as iron attracted by a magnetic stone moves automatically towards the magnet, my consciousness, having been changed by his will, is attracted to Lord Vishnu, who carries a disc in his hand. Thus I have no independence." So this is the situation, and this is the situation that this Python Avadhut is trying to describe also. He's saying, give up all these different concepts, these different ideas of good and bad. The whole idea of good and bad is a material concept. Spiritually speaking, there is no good and bad. Everything is good because everything comes from Krishna. So this Avadhut saying that we need to accept both good and bad as one unit, and then invest that unit within the mind, because that's the nature of the mind. It's to accept and reject. Accept what the mind perceives as being beneficial, as good, and reject what the mind perceives as being bad, unbeneficial. But, you know, even still, it's difficult for most people to see how to practically translate this very esoteric level of dealings into practical reality. How is it that I can get my hands into this? How is it that I can actually practically apply it within my life? Most people don't even have a clue about the nature of their own self. They don't even know what's going on within their own consciousness. They don't know what they're thinking. They don't know what they want to do. They don't know what they don't want to do. They don't know what their goal of life is. Basically, they don't know anything about themselves, so how can they possibly be expected to understand such esoteric topics? That's why within our particular line of disciplic succession, it's been made very simple and very easy. Srila Bhaktivedanta Thakur, in one of his poems called Shuddha Bhakta, describes this actually very nicely. How easy it is to make this transformation happen. Because really, you know, just like driving a car or operating a computer, it's a very simple process. It doesn't require a lot of technical knowledge and technical details. Like with driving a car, all you have to do is turn the key, or in some of the more modern cars, just push a button. And then all you have to do is worry about the gas pedal, the brake, and steering. It's a very simple thing. But at the same time, you know, the engine and the electronics that go into it is quite complex. So if you start describing to someone, oh, well, you know, this particular relay needs to be activated first, and then these things need to happen, and these different pumps and motors need to be going, and you know, these different fluids need to be circulating in this particular order, and the pistons need to fire in this particular succession, and it's all very confusing. It's very complex. People will become bewildered very quickly. That's why there's people such as mechanics who deal with that for you. That's why here in this temple, whenever something happens, everyone goes running to Ratna first. For Ratna, it's very simple. It's very easy to understand. But for most people, it's completely bewildering and confusing. How does this happen? How does this work? But if you get a simple enough explanation, you know, you turn the key, start the car, and push on the gas, and turn the steering wheel like this, and then you can drive. It can be simplified tremendously. So in the same way, the process of bhakti yoga can be tremendously simplified. We don't need to worry about, you know, so many esoteric understandings. So in this poem, Shuddha Bhakta, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, "The dust from the lotus feet of a pure devotee give rise to devotional service. And service of the devotees is itself the supreme perfection and the root of the tender creeper of divine love." This is actually one of the most profound things, because we don't fully appreciate the importance of association with devotees. In fact, in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, Krishna is explaining in the Uddhava Gita, I believe it's the 11th chapter of the 11th canto, that association with devotees is so important that, in fact, it's actually the most important aspect, the most important process of Krishna consciousness. And that by this one thing alone, simply by your association, you can go back to Godhead. And then Krishna gives a large list of all these different extremely exalted devotees that achieved the highest goal for no other reason than the association they kept. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur continues, "With great care I observe holy days like Ekadasi and Janmashtami, for they are the mother devotion. And with the greatest reverence I love and choose as my dwelling place the transcendental abode of Sri Krishna. In the company of loving devotees I will visit all those places where my Lord Gaurasundar traveled and performed his pastimes. My mind always begs to hear the music of the mridanga, and my heart dances in ecstasy when I hear the kind of kirtan established by Lord Gaurachandra. I feel supreme bliss when I behold the deity forms of the divine couple, Sri Sri Radha and Krishna, and I conquer all worldly illusions by honoring the Lord's prasadam. Every day Goloka Vrindavan appears in my home when I see Lord Hari being worshipped there. My joy knows no bounds when I see the Ganges River, a river of nectar emanating from the Lord's lotus feet. The sight of the Tulasi plant soothes my soul, for I know she gives pleasure to Lord Krishna. I feel that my life has been fulfilled when I honor shak, a green leafy vegetable preparation that is a favorite of Lord Chaitanya's. Whatever Bhaktivinoda obtains that furthers devotional service to Sri Krishna, he accepts every day with the greatest joy. So it's a very simple process. In these eight brief verses, Bhaktivinoda Thakur encapsulates the entirety of this bhakti yoga process. It's so simple. Associate with devotees, celebrate wonderful festivals and holy days, worship the Lord, sing in kirtan, worship Tulsi, honor prasadam. It's very simple. And Srila Prabhupada also, he distilled it down in a similar fashion. He compiled the essence of preaching. You know, aside from distributing books, which of course is the backbone of the preaching, because we need to propagate awareness of Krishna consciousness. And the power of literature should never be underestimated. That's why Prabhupada always cited the example of the communists dropping leaflets in Bengal and Bangladesh and conquering that entire region simply by dropping pamphlets. They didn't actually personally go there. But the whole area became communist simply by reading leaflets dropped from airplanes or helicopters. But talking more about cultivation, Prabhupada has established the idea of holding festivals. And Prabhupada's idea of festival, it was very simple. For a festival, all one needs to do is have some Krishna katha, take some prasadam, and chant kirtan. In fact, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's one particular verse talking about the home of Advaitacharya, describing Advaitacharya's activities and how every evening he would have the Vaishnavas congregate in his home. And they would have some Krishna katha, take Krishna prasadam, and then have kirtan. And in the purport, it's rather interesting. Prabhupada says that all devotees should do this in their home, according to their means. And that this is the process of this Sankirtan festival, congregationally chanting the holy names of the Lord. And he said that everyone should do this kirtan, the Sankirtan, at minimum 3 hours daily. And by this process, people will become devotees. People will become attracted. Whether we live in the temple or outside of the temple, if we have little or no association, by this simple process of having Krishna katha, like reading from the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna book, whatever, taking a little Krishna prasadam and chanting Hare Krishna. By this simple process, people will become attracted. People's hearts will become changed. And they will become devotees. This is our process for cultivation, for developing people into Vaishnavas. And it's such a powerful process. In many different occasions, Prabhupada kept referencing what he called the Hare Krishna festivals. You can look in the Vedabase. He talks about it quite a lot. Having these different Hare Krishna festivals and attracting 10, 20, 30, and sometimes even 40, 50, 60,000 people at these different pandal programs in India. And Prabhupada is glorifying this, saying that this is so wonderful. This is the perfect means for attracting people to Krishna. And even in his letters, talking to different disciples here in the United States, different disciples were asking how to enthuse devotees in Krishna consciousness. how to keep their enthusiasm up, how to preach and cultivate people. And in one letter, Prabhupada, just paraphrasing, but he basically said, hold festivals. It doesn't matter what the occasion is. You can make the occasion anything. Simply hold a festival using any excuse. Have some Krishna Katha. Take some prasadam. And chant the holy names. This is our process. So whether we have, you know, a sunrise festival, or we have a spring festival, or we have an autumn festival, or we have a St. Patrick's Day festival, whatever, it doesn't matter. The excuse for the festival is meaningless. Of course, we should always have festivals like Bhaktivinoda Thakur said on auspicious days within our tradition, like Janmashtami, the appearance of Lord Chaitanya, Gaur Purnim. But at the same time, you know, we don't need to be limited. We don't need to be bound by simply holy days, appearance days and disappearance days. We can have a festival every day. And in some places, Prabhupada even said that. We should have a continuous Sankirtan festival, chanting, dancing, glorifying the holy names of the Lord. And in this way, everyone will become enlivened and enthusiastic in Krishna's service. And it's a very easy thing. It doesn't require, you know, tremendous intellectual capacity or perceptive insight into the subtle esoterics of what's happening with bhakti yoga. It doesn't require any of that. All we have to do is engage our tongue, tasting the Lord's remnants, chanting the Lord's holy names, and associating with devotees. In fact, Devamrita Swami, one time I was asking him about his cultivation programs, because I wasn't really familiar with it. And so I was asking specifics, you know, what about this and what about that? And he said, oh, that's meaningless. All you have to do is come up with any excuse to give devotee association to non-devotees. And that's the essence of it. Just coming up with excuses to allow karmis to associate with devotees. That's the bottom line. Because what happens when somebody associates with devotees? Naturally, Krishna Katha happens. You take prasadam, you chant the holy names. It's very simple. And in this way, people become Krishna conscious. So I'll end there if there's any comments or questions. John? Yeah. Ki jai. And then prasadam. And there's devotee association right here. Yeah.
We can do that every day.
You're right. It's a continuous festival. That's why this process is so simple. Simply by giving people excuses to come around the temple and associate with devotees, they naturally become devotees. In fact, in one place, Prabhupada is talking about having karmis work for Krishna, because some devotees were complaining. Oh, Prabhupada, you know, how is it that karmis can be doing, you know, working? How can we hire karmis? And Prabhupada said, there's nothing wrong with hiring karmis. The fact that they're coming here and working for Krishna is their greatest benefit. Simply by working for Krishna, even if they're paid, their hearts will be changed. And we've seen that practically. Here in this temple, we've had different projects, different construction projects, like the guy who polished this marble floor last. Simply by polishing the floor, Krishna's floor in the temple room, he started associating with the devotees, taking prasadam, and his heart changed. He became very favorable to Krishna consciousness. So any excuse, it doesn't matter the excuse. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Granth Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.